All right, so it's a pretty rough start with when we talk about that, but it reminds us that this is not merely an intellectual exercise that we're dealing with here, right? So now, what are some of the aspects of that video that stand out to you in terms of maybe how they pulled it, how they structured it? Yeah, started off really noble, right? So it starts off with noble aims, noble words, right? And then what happens as the video progresses? Yeah, and it's not necessarily that this is what all war leads to, but it is what war can lead to, right? That which begins with a noble cause. Like, let's reaffirm the nobility of the German people. How did that work out? Well, didn't quite go so well, right? For the world, right? So it starts off with a noble cause.
Sounded good in the beginning, is what you're saying.
Yes.
It sounded good.
Yeah.
You know, look up the motherland, the history, all that.
Yeah.
Stuff. But war is never without pain.
Yeah. And then you come to that. Also, you come to that line in there. They said, "By any means necessary," right? And it's like, do we truly mean that? Is that just a turn of phrase, or is that actually what it's meant? Because if that's what it's meant, then what do we mean by any means? Do we really mean any means necessary, or what are the limits? And if there are limits, what are those limits? And so, and by the way, happy Mother's Day. So this is the best Mother's Day Sunday school we've ever had. So let's talk about war. So this is, but this is very important for nations and leaders, especially who make these decisions, to take these things seriously, because these decisions have real consequences. And it doesn't mean, like we talked about last week, that there can't be civilian casualties. But it does mean that those need to be taken into account and taken seriously. And that it's not just kill them all, let God sort them out. That kind of attitude. So the two main prongs of just conduct, we've talked about one of them already, right? Discrimination. And so today, we are going to be talking about proportionality. Now, what is the word, even before we get into an actual definition of it, what does the word proportionality, what can you suss out from even that word itself that may indicate what we're talking about?
Portion.
Portion, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
part of something.
Yeah, proportion.
Yeah.
That proportion, right? The portion, you know, if you're separating it out, you know, it's, you know, separate off the pro. It's the prefix and then portion. And so it's the pro, essentially for, like the portion for, the proportion, right? The proportion for something, right? The amount of something we're going to use, the proportionality. And so before we get into proportionality, it's important to go back, because these two things go together, and they're going to bleed into each other as well. Discrimination, proportionality in this, you'll see that they'll cover. We will revisit some themes and some even issues that we talked about last week as we get into this, because these concepts are obviously related, because they both fall under just conduct. And so discrimination is about the question of who and what is and is not a legitimate target in just war. And so, what were some examples of that we said were legitimate targets?
Combatants.
Yeah. Guys in uniforms with guns, you know, like that. They're, you know, obviously the soldiers. What about other like structures or buildings?
Yeah, like we talked about places that our military facilities or places that build things. Not always, but places that build things for.
Yeah, munitions factories that are constructing jet fighters. Like, these are all, like, if they're making the means of war as a means of production, then they are a legitimate target in war. And so, these are legitimate. And what are some obvious illegitimate targets in war, or include whether people or structures?
Schools, hospitals.
Yeah.
Civilians generally.
Yes, speaking. We know that it gets complicated. Well, actually, I think we might actually talk a little bit about terrorism today. If I remember right. But if we're just talking about purely basic concepts, right? If the world was nice and clean and neat, right? But these are the areas you would avoid, and these are the structures you would go after, and then these are the people that you would legitimately target, and these are the people you clearly would avoid targeting. But we also talked about how I'm gonna go ahead and skip forward here. Talked about biblical roots. We talked about how one may not intentionally kill non-combatants, right? If there's a school with a bunch of children in it, you can't intentionally bomb it just to freak your opponent out, your enemy out. Like, that's like, this will really demoralize them if we kill all these, kill their children. Like, that's not a legitimate target in war. That is unacceptable. If you're going to do a just war, if you're just in total war mode and you just want to, you know, destroy your opponent, then you may do that, but you're doing it in an immoral and unjust way. So we talked about how intentional non-combatant deaths are murder. Intentional, not unintentional. Intentional non-combatant deaths are murder. And so if we're intentionally targeting civilians, that is murder. We asked the question and answered it. Can non-combatants be unintentionally killed in war? The answer is
yes,
they can. You can have foreseeable civilian casualties in a military operation. You do your best to minimize those, but if it is a necessary necessary operation to help to next step, to help bring about an end to the conflict, then it is not murder. When you have non-combatants unintentionally killed. So let's see here. So we said yes, non-combatant deaths can be unintentional but foreseeable. And we included by saying it is a just nation's responsibility not only to protect their people but also enemy non-combatants as best they can do both. Does that sound easy or difficult?
Very difficult?
It is very difficult. Because we don't always fight people who play by the same rules. Right? It doesn't mean the enemy is going to try to do the same for us. But if we are actually saying we are going to do a just war. And I find this interesting because think about this. So what are all the reasons that you've heard from Russia that they have gone to war against Ukraine? What are some of the reasons? I'm not saying they're true, but what are the reasons? Does anyone know of any reasons that Russia has given as to why they are invading Ukraine?
They're accusing the Ukrainians of being fascists.
Yeah.
Fascists, yes. Drug-addled Nazis. So with the Jewish president, for some reason. They're very sneaky. They're very sneaky Nazis. So there's that. Also, reclaiming... the land, as was part of the original heritage of Russia, right? But it's interesting is, why can't Putin just say, because I want it? Like, why can't he just publicly say, because I want it, and it's mine, now, and I want it? Didn't empires do that before?
Yeah.
They just saw a choice piece of land. Hey, they got a bunch of agriculture. They got a lot of crops. Hey, I mean, Rome did it with Egypt. Yep. So, like, hey, why not just take it? Like, isn't it interesting, though? Just observe it.
Huh? Like a brat. It doesn't settle well to the world.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? Go ahead.
It causes you problems with other people. You're not doing it because you care. And you would do that, but it's only for the consequences with other yeah. parties who aren't. Mm-hmm.
But it, kind of like if no one was watching.
But he's trying to create, in that situation, create a certain a perception with his home folks back home that are not seeing what's happening in the war. So he has to have a story out there that they'll say, well, yeah, he's trying to do good.
Yeah, it's very, because control state media, that's very putting a very specific narrative before the Russian people. But isn't it interesting, though, that even for his own people and for the international world, that he feels compelled to put out these reasons that we all know he's lying about, or some which he may believe delusionally, but that they're putting out these reasons because they want to be seen as having a just war.
Yeah.
And so they feel compelled to be able to put these reasons out, and they don't feel like, well, I'm just going to say because I like it and I want it and it's ours now. Right? Because that's what they used to do. Notice how there's that compulsion for even a country that is engaged in a clearly unjust war to pretend as though they are in a just conflict. So just notice that just by observation that compulsion that is there to be able to publicly put that out there. So let's go ahead and move forward. So we went through this. We won't go through this list again, but we talked about different combatants. And this is where it got real muddy, you know, where it got really confusing. We weren't sure because these questions get really confusing. They get really muddy about who actually is a combatant. And it's and then we concluded here saying, discriminate as much as you can, afford to, with concern for your nation's combatants and non-combatants, as well as enemy non-combatants. Now, that's what we call pretty gray. Right? That's not clear, right? And because it's not clear, because it's really, really hard. And like I said, it depends on the stakes, you know. We talked about the difference last week. We talked about how, you know, we have certain stakes, certain things that have compelled us to send our military overseas to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to different to these different places across the world. But the stakes are very different than, say, the stakes that the Ukrainian people are facing with the invasion of Russia, right? Even in World War II, we never had, aside from Pearl Harbor, we never had any enemy with boots on the ground in our own country, right? So the stakes, even though they were high, they still were not as high as they were, say, in England, where Churchill's coming saying, they may come for us and we will die to the last man and we will fight them at every part of the island. FDR wasn't making that speech because we went out as a defensive measure. We went offensively out to Japan and out to Europe, right? To keep them from coming. And so it depends on the stakes and the acceptable level of risk, for our forces and for non-combatants. And so as the stakes get higher, the level of risk we're willing to engage in goes higher as well. But certain lines should never be crossed. We should never intentionally target civilians. And then the last line here is love your neighbor as yourself. It still governs how we operate in war as believers and military personnel and as civilians who support the war effort. So now let's get into proportionality. So we already identified a bit of what the word is. And so essentially it's the amount of force that may be brought to bear against an enemy in the prosecution of a just war, right? So, remember, you can have just conduct, but unless you have just cause, it's still an unjust war, right? So just because you use the right amount of force to go take your neighbor's stuff does not make you right. You're like, well, I didn't kill him. They're like, well, you took his stuff. Like, that's not okay, right? So, um, So that's that. And so just cause matters. And this is why what I mean by we don't want to just use just war theory as a checklist. And so well, we checked off half the boxes, you know, but our just cause wasn't there. Like that doesn't work. So. But we're talking about the amount of force. And here's a key question to think about. What is necessary to attack to attain the end, just end of the war? It's not just about the weapons we choose. We'll talk about that in a moment. But it's also the amount, the places where we will attack. How far into the country do we go? Which cities do we go to? What military bases do we take out? What are the strategic targets? How far do we go in terms of the places we go and the power that we bring to bear in those cities? So going back to the original Sun Tzu, not a believer, of course, but wrote the original book on war. And said, in the practical art of war, the best thing of all is to take the enemy's country whole and intact. To shatter and destroy is not so good. Sun Tzu was good with understatements, right? But that was the thing. He was a master of war, but he knew the best thing was not to utterly destroy a city. Because what good is that for anybody? It just gives you a big, you won a pile of rubble. Good for you. Enjoy. You know, it's like it's much better to take the city intact, which also means he also talked about building a golden bridge for your enemy to escape. You know, so that way you can get your enemy out of there, you can take the territory, now you get the city. Right? And so so even now you hear that kind of talk, even with Ukraine and Russia, so they're saying, what's the off-ramp for Putin? We've moved from bridges to off-ramps. But what's the golden bridge for Putin? How can he back out of this in a way that can save life and bring this war to an end and still restore the territory to the Ukraine? How can, you know, but to think about that for your enemy in order to minimize the bloodshed. But let's talk about weapons. So, what types of, I'm going to give you a statement and then I want us to come up with some examples of weapons that we think match this. So we're talking about proportionality. The weapons that we ought not to use, unless the highest stakes are there, and even then, in some cases, never. Are weapons that are naturally indiscriminate, unnecessarily cruel, or unjust. And so I want to take unjust off, because that's more of a concept. But what weapons can you come to mind that would be, by their very design, indiscriminate, unable to discriminate, or unnecessarily cruel? So, atomic weapons, yep. Chemical.
The gas that was used in World War One.
Yeah, mustard gas.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Biological. Yep. Yeah. Infecting the viruses that would kill.
I guess like carpet bombing, where you just bomb everything.
Mm-hmm. Napalm. Yeah, that type of bombing. So napalm. Now in World War II, we did a lot of carpet or firebombing. What is the advantage of firebombing as opposed to what might be the advantage of fire or carpet bombing a place as opposed to specific bombs that you're dropping individually? How accurate do you have to be? Right, yeah, and that's that was the problem because when they were dropping bombs in World War II and World War One, they're dropping them manually, and so they're just guessing and they miss their targets all the time, and so they switched strategy, especially in World War II when it came to Japan, they said, look, we're going to switch to firebombing, and so they started firebombing because the bombing was so inaccurate, and so now.
Did we have laser-guided targeting systems?
No.
No. So this was what we had to offer, and how high were the stakes?
Extremely.
This is World War II, right? These were extremely high. So the stakes are so high, and so the risk that we were willing to take was much higher. And so, but it is more naturally indiscriminate. What about mines?
Mines?
Land or sea. I mean, there's parts of Europe where they still have mines buried in the ground. They just got the section marked off because they can't use the land because, you'll die, right? Because you'll get blown up if you don't know where they are. And that's the whole thing. The whole idea of a weapon that's indiscriminate is that it can't target. And so it can't tell the difference between a combatant and a non-combatant. And they still have some mines that are still floating around the ocean. They turn up every once in a while. Thankfully, a lot of them are duds now. But it's been long enough that they've finally gone offline. But they're still out there. Some of them are still potent. You know, you don't know if they're going to go off or not. They're highly unstable. So,
the,
yes.
It's illegal when you retreat because you, that's the indiscriminate. It keeps the people you're fighting from coming back in. Even though you left,
yeah.
you leave your minds to.
That's why you can't booby trap your back door.
Your neighbor or your cat or your wife or somebody.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a true story about a guy who kept getting his mailbox knocked down by teenagers, so he filled his mailbox with cement. And a teenager came by and hit with a bat, bashed the back and hit the kid, and the kid ended up in the hospital, got him in jail. And I'm torn about that because I'm like, I got a lot of sympathy for that dude in his mailbox and these punk teenagers. And if he hadn't been swinging the bat, he hadn't brought it on himself. But the case was, it was overkill. You laid a trap for someone and they physically harmed themselves as a result of it. And so it's just kind of one of those things where it's like, but it's one of those things where I'm kind of like, oh man. And also overkill. So there was I know of a tanker who he's out and this was early 2000s in kind of Afghanistan and so he's in one of these big F-1 Abrams tanks and there's guys that come there's this one guy in particular that's coming, he's running at the tank, and so he gets on the vision, the camera, and he looks at the guy, and the guy's wearing a vest, and he's like, okay, this guy's gonna blow himself up. Alright, so the tank has three guns on it. The smallest caliber gun a tank has is a 50 caliber. And so he turns on the 50 cal and he targets the guy and hits the button and it goes. He accidentally fired the main cannon, which is a depleted uranium shell, which cost several hundred thousand apiece, number one. But also, he just fired that at a single human being. This is something you fire at structures, at tanks, at other things. And the Geneva Convention requires if you use above a certain caliber weapon upon an enemy that you have to go catalog it and note it. And so they went out and they couldn't find his remains. Because the guy had been vaporized by it. And that was unintentional. The guy was a suicide bomber. The guy wasn't going to make it anyway, no matter what he did. And a 50 cal would have definitely killed him. But still, it's one of those things where even we see those regulations that we even follow there, where the type of gun you use is important depending on what enemy you're dealing with. And so it's for practical resources and also for humane resources.
That changes though. If we're here at home and there's no limit to what I would use personally.
Right. So it changes when we're at home because the stakes go much higher.
Yeah.
Right. So if someone's coming at us at our home, the enemy's invading, and we have kind of like a Red Dawn situation, where you have that the invading force coming into your home. It's like, well, then I'm going to use whatever I can to get that enemy out of here, because the stakes are his life or mine, right? And so the stakes don't get any higher than that. And so it's like, and so it goes from here to here. When you have a tank versus one dude, even with an explosive vest, you know, that looks like that's a different scenario. And so it's like the stakes aren't nearly as high, but the stakes are higher, but they're not as, it's not like invading force coming to my home or someone breaking into my house at night that's armed, you know, then that's high. Or even if I don't know they're armed. All right, well, let's go over to targets. So mines, nuclear, biological, chemical weapons, any kind of overkill, even on the combatants. Another example of this is there are certain bombs. We don't do this, but others do. They make these glass-lined bombs, and so they explode and they cause shards of glass to go into you. But glass is invisible to X-rays, and so it can't be removed. And so you have to live the rest of your life, if you survive, with in a lot of pain, with glass shards in your body that don't come out. So this is that type of stuff. You know, the Boston Marathon bomb, you know, putting the screws and putting all this stuff. Now, that was an act of terrorism, but that is not a legitimate, weapon to use. In war, that we would use, because it causes undue, inhumane suffering, because it just sends a bunch of shrapnel everywhere. And so, we don't want to make our enemies suffer. If we're going to kill them, we simply want to kill them and end their life, so that way we can end the threat and end the war. That's the goal. Not to make them suffer in pain and torture them, and so we do not use glass-lined bombs.
Which general didn't he shoot a missile at a car in like Iraq or Iran?
Yeah, so in Afghanistan, right. Yeah, that was an anti-terrorism operation with botched intelligence where we used a drone and we hit a car. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And it was basically just had a bunch of civilians in it. Suleimani?
Yeah, that's it.
Suleimani? Yeah, yes. Okay, sorry. A different scenario, which was, he was a combatant, okay? He was a terrorist operating in Iraq, just outside of Baghdad, and we hit his car with a drone, and so, and that guy was a combatant.
The type of bomb he used, it was unconditional, but it was actually safer for everybody else. It was a mechanical bomb.
Yeah.
It wasn't explosive.
Oh, okay.
And
we're always like, that's the thing, it's like we're developing technologies not to do maximum amount of pain and maximum amount of explosions. We're often designing technology to get more precise and to minimize civilian casualties. Like, that's one of the philosophies we have in our weapons development. And so which is something that's noble, it's something that's needed. Because we don't want to just kill civilians willy-nilly. But we do want to take out the bad guys. We do want to take out the enemy combatants. So, alright, well, let's talk about targets here. This is where we get into discrimination a bit as well. What do we think are legitimate targets for just war? If we're going at the enemy, so we already said combatants, right? Combatants. We said what about facilities that arm or defend combatants?
Anything that's part of the command and control.
Yeah.
It could be any type of structure, from a tent to an elaborate building, but it's where the military guys are.
Yeah.
More.
Um,
What about religious or cultural sites?
Not.
Yeah, not unless what?
Unless
they're using the arm or house combatants, right? Then in that case, and even then, we'll hold out from doing it as long as possible because, you know, we know what happens if you blow up a mosque, right? But we have done stuff like that, or we find alternative ways to do it. We'll figure out ways that don't involve it.
So what about infrastructure that supports both military and civilians?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, this one is muddy because it's not like, oh, there's a military jeep there, so we can just blow up the port, right? But at the same time, if they're taking in goods and services that civilians use and military shipments, well, then it may be a legitimate target. It just honestly just depends on the case, on the scenario. So it just depends on what it is.
Yeah. Infrastructure, but sometimes it's necessary to cut off the flow of
weapons. Yeah. I mean, think about the Ukrainians flooded a town flooded its own town just to stop the Russian advancement. I mean, think about that. Like, they sacrificed their own town just to stop the Russians. So, water purification facilities. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. Are they primarily feeding into the military structure, or is they primarily civilian use? Again, it's murky, and you got to look at the situation. What are the stakes, right? What the stakes are does make a difference. Like you may say, we're not going to. Maybe that's the last. That's lowest on the priority right now. We're not going to go for that right now. But then as the stakes raise, we may be willing to add other things to the list. As the stakes get higher.
Depends on going back to what Sun Tzu says about, you know, what do you want to take the country, or are you just like sending a message, or are you getting revenge?
Yeah, that's a good point. If you poison the water, right? And then, like, how are you going to put your people there? Like, if you poison the water of a town to kill everybody, well, your citizens aren't going to want to go live there. They got poison. You just poisoned all the wells, you know. So you know, how is that going to help? Yeah, and that was definitely a message by example. So let's see here. So we have one more video that we're going to watch here. And this one's 4 minutes, and it does not have the same disturbing images. So.
Since the beginning, humans have resorted to violence as a way to settle disagreements. Yet through the ages, people from around the world have tried to limit the brutality of war. It was this humanitarian spirit that led to the first Geneva Convention of 1864 and to the birth of modern international humanitarian law. Setting the basic limits on how wars can be fought, these universal laws of war protect those not fighting, as well as those no longer able to. To do this, a distinction must always be made between who or what may be attacked and who or what must be spared and protected. Most importantly, civilians can never be targeted. To do so is a war crime.
Into our village. They shouted that they were going to kill everyone. I was so scared. I ran to hide in the bush. I heard my mother screaming. I thought I would never see her again.
Every possible care must be taken to avoid harming civilians or destroying things essential for their survival. They have a right to receive the help they need. has lived in never used to bother me. People like him were the reason my brother was dead. He was the enemy and was nothing to me. But then I realized that behind bars, he was out of action and no longer a threat to me and my family. The laws of war prohibit torture and other ill treatment of detainees, whatever their past. They must be given food and water and allowed to communicate with loved ones. This preserves their dignity and keeps them alive. Medical workers save lives, sometimes in the most dangerous conditions.
Fighters from both sides were wounded in a deadly battle. We were taking them to the nearest hospital. At the checkpoint, the soldiers threatened us to treat his men only. We were running out of time, and I was afraid that now all of them were going to die.
Medical workers must always be allowed to do their job, and the Red Cross or Red Crescent must not be attacked. The sick or wounded have a right to be cared for, regardless of whose side they are on. Advances in weapons technology have meant that the rules of war have also had to adapt. Because some weapons and methods of warfare don't distinguish between fighters and civilians, limits on their use have been agreed. In the future, wars may be fought with fully autonomous robots. But will such robots ever have the ability to distinguish between a military target and someone who must never be attacked? No matter how sophisticated weapons become, it is essential that they are in line with the rules of war. International humanitarian law is all about making choices that preserve a minimum of human dignity in times of war and make sure that living together again is possible once the last bullet has been shot.
All right, so we only have about a minute or two left here. So this pretty much gives a, the video gives a quick summary, which is why we use it. And so, basically, when we talk to the Navy pilots, this is what we tell them is that we must be better and wiser warriors than our enemies, so that we may fight with the most restrictive discrimination and proportionality possible. And it reminds me of a definition of meekness that I came across when I was studying the Sermon on the Mount. And that meekness is not about being weak. Meekness is more like a sword that is in its sheath. Meekness is a sheath sword. It is power restrained with a purpose. And that as a country and as Christians, as we think about war and when we engage war, if we're not pacifists, and we believe that there are times where God would call us to support a just war, then that means that we are also responsible to be restrictive in who we are firing at, how much we go, and that it's not, we can't simply say, we're going to be any means necessary. They kill one of our guys, we'll take 70 of their civilians out. We don't care. We'll bomb 70 villages of theirs to teach them a lesson, that kind of thing. It's like, we can't go that route because we are called to something better. We are still called to love our neighbor, even if our neighbor is our enemy. But also, there is life that must be taken in order to bring that war to an end. And so we need to do as much and Lord willing, no further than is absolutely necessary. So let's stop there today. Thank y'all.